Let's get this party started.
Welcome to the I Squint Podcast.
Hi, and welcome back to the I Squint Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Lang. In this, the sixth episode, I sat down with fellow lighting designer and blogger Lucas Kresch. You may know Lucas from his lighting blog, LightQ23. On his blog, Lucas discusses the principles of lighting and working within the industry. Lucas is a freelance lighting designer from Berkeley, California, and was recently in DC with the Levy Dance Company, lighting a dance piece called Everyone Intimate Alone Visibly. It ran here in DC for about a week and moved on to New York City and ran for an additional week there. I was able to pull Lucas away from the theater one night to have a bite to eat, talk about lighting, and some of the interesting posts that he's put together. Lucas has some fascinating points about his approach to lighting design and some of the theories of lighting. Lucas also has a fantastic series of posts dealing with personal finances and freelancing. We talk about these topics and more all over a good piece of chow and tasty beverages. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Lucas Kresch.
All right, so I'm here with Lucas Kresch. You guys might know him from the Twitter world. I forget, what is your Twitter
now? Lucas Kresch.
Is it Lucas Kresch? Uh-huh. At Lucas Kresch.
At Lucas Kresch, excuse me.
And of course, you probably know him from his Twitter account, Lucas Kresch, excuse me. Lucas, I wanted to talk a little bit. Well, first, you know, thanks for doing the podcast with me. It's a real pleasure to meet you finally in person.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's, you know, convenient that I'm doing a show in D.C.
I know. What do you think of D.C.?
I haven't spent enough time here this time around to get a sense of it, but I worked here a number of years ago and had a great time.
Well, so. you got to ditch the dance place for a little bit and get into the city, man. It's beautiful right now. It's what? I think it was 55 degrees today.
Yeah, no, I heard it was lovely outside.
You wouldn't know. You're stuck in the theater all day. Exactly. Isn't that the life we lead?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about that life, how we lead our lives. Give me a little history. You know, I've looked at your resume, and good God, just looking at your assistant designs, we've got Richard Foreman. You did a little bit with him on Idiot Savant.
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
That was probably one of the most unique, if not the most unique, theater experiences I've ever been a part of.
Yeah. Okay. You really have to go in depth now. Now you got me curious.
The way that I think of Richard's work is that he's functionally created his own genre of theater. I mean, he was, you know, one of the forerunners of the New York downtown avant-garde movement, and you know, people tend to have very strong reactions to his work. It's either, you know, they start bowing down and worship at his feet, or, you know, leave the theater and discuss visibly, you know,
disgusting.
With their hands in the air, just, you know, what is this nonsense?
Well, now that you've said that, real quick, which one were you?
I moved to New York City in the fall of 2001 to start graduate school at NYU.
Okay.
And I had a sense of what I was, like, the kind of performance work that I was going, you know, why I wanted to be specifically in New York when I was studying. And, you know, I mean, not just, you know, I mean, New York's a great city, but also just the kind of work that was done there. But I didn't have anyone specifically, you know, oh, I'm going to, you know, I want to see their work. It was more just the New York scene.
Yeah, get the whole immersion.
Exactly. And I saw that first fall, I went to see a Richard Foreman show, Maria del Bosco. And I had never seen anything like it before. It was, it really was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. And my experience of watching it was, it was like, you know, as I was leaving the theater, because I couldn't quite process the experience while I was seeing it. It was just, it was too much, it was overload, and it was amazing. And the thought that I had was like, this is why I came to New York. It was like for this kind of work.
So you had that, oh my God, I need to do this.
I want to be doing this kind of work, and you know, this you know, sort of experimental, on the edge, kind of theater work and dance, and you know, experimental opera, and really, you know, it's like how can we sort of push the boundaries of aesthetic considerations in a performative context?
So I'm assuming the Idiot Savant at the Public in New York City did it for you, huh?
That was...
Did it live up to the expectations?
The experience was... Richard is one of the most precise theater makers I've ever worked with. And, I mean, from day one of rehearsals, he has full set, full costumes, actors have memorized their lines, and a full light rig in the air. And they start at the beginning of the play and just start working through. And whenever it comes to stop, like, we need to change, you know, we need to add something to the costume, we need to add something to the set, let's adjust the lighting for this. You know, say this line this way, you know, why don't you try entering from here? And it's, you know, it's from day one, all the elements are there, and he just starts methodically moving through the play, you know, and then he gets to the end and starts back at the beginning and does this for months.
Okay.
And he reaches this level of detail that certainly I've not seen in any other American work. I mean, it's more common in European companies that have, you know, the luxury of more state-funded arts and whatnot, where they can take these longer rehearsal processes. And he really takes advantage of that, you know, and it's all about coming from this, like, spontaneous, aesthetic, emotional, spiritual place of creation that he creates in the theater. And it's just everything is focused on the moment and what is happening, and is it working and is it not? It's not, and that's the only concern. It's like, is this moment working? Does it look right? Does it sound right? And if it doesn't, you know,
let's fix it right now. Okay.
And, you know, you'll be plowing through, you know, a supposed run and stop, and it's like, okay, this moment isn't working. We need to fix it and go back to the beginning.
Okay.
It really is astounding. I mean, I've worked with a number of people who are who work in, you know, in similar levels of detail. In graduate school, I had the opportunity to work with the Romanian director Liviu Chule, who, coming from you know, large state-funded European situation, had that sort of mentality built in, and even approached a American style, you know, an American production schedule with that mentality. So he was fine if we never got a run through. Like, we didn't need a run through. We needed to get the light cue right.
You need to get everything right.
You know, we need
to
get the sound cue right. Like, we need to get that entrance, you know, not on the first word, but on the middle of the second word.
Sure.
You know, I mean, and really just taking the experience and giving it the level of attention and detail that really, you know, with ticket prices and the amount of time that theater or dance or opera takes, like, it's almost insulting if you're not
perfect.
If you're not taking that level of detail or as much detail as you can. It's like, you need to give it your A game, and you need to bring your full attention and your full concern to the work, because you're asking people to spend a not insignificant amount of money and a considerable amount of time to watch what you're doing. You know, it's not like, you know, you paint something, like, you know, the viewer can spend 30 seconds looking at your painting, they can spend, you know, a lifetime analyzing it, but the time, you know, the amount of time they spend with it is up to the viewer. In live performance, they're captive. I mean, they can walk out, obviously, but, you know, generally, you've got them for, you know, an hour and a half, 3 hours, whatever.
Sure.
Whatever it is, and, you know, I mean, and when you're demanding that level of participation with your audience, I feel it's incumbent upon those who are creating the work to put that level of attention into the work itself.
Well, I can tell your level of experience here. you know, not only with some of the work that I've seen done from your website, you know, some of your photos and everything, but your blog, some of the details that you go into about color theory and your other series about color, or not color management, but finances with a freelancer. You know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that because a lot of people read your blog. Well, they read mine, of course, for things like this, but I, of course, don't do perceptual things like color theory. What got you started into doing this? What got you started writing about color theory, you know, personal finances, about this kind of information?
The blog started in 2006, in the spring. I've always written in one form or another. I mean, whether it was, you know, bad poetry in high school or, you know, little journals, or I tried a couple of blogs, I've tried fiction, I've done a lot of writing, but I've never quite, I hadn't, you know, there wasn't really a form that really stuck with me, and then I tried just, you know, this sort of, you know, blogging my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that's essentially what a blog is, you know.
Yeah. So when I started in 2006, there were, as far as I knew, there were no other design blogs. Certainly, nothing as specific as lighting design.
Mm-hmm.
There were a handful of theater blogs, and I'm thinking maybe 6-8 people, mostly in New York, one in Seattle, and you know there may well be others that weren't. But
sure,
as
yeah.
far as like the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I mean, blogs, Twitter, and these sort of things are all about the conversation. You can be off talking about yourself, but if you're not, you know, connecting and reaching out.
Well, that's what social media is.
Exactly. So social as far network. As the conversation was going, it's, you know, this, like, small little group of, like, 6 or 8 people. And they were a combination of writers, directors, and actors.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and I was sort of the odd man out, being, you know, designer,
technician,
exactly,
yeah,
and then, you know, so to the, you know, so sort of in, so starting in that conversation about, you know, the nature of theater and, you know, how, you know, what can we do, and, you know, dealing with, you know, and there was just sort of this sort of ongoing conversation about sort of theater specific to New York that was going on. And as time went on, sort of more people started joining the conversation, and people started, you know, realizing that, oh, you know, so-and-so is really doing their own thing, and I'm not interested in talking to them, and, you know, everyone kind of went off in their own directions, and, you know, certainly that same conversation is still going on, and there's plenty of blogs. If you want to know about the, you know, current state of the New York theater scene, you know, there are blogs that are going on talking about that are mostly, you know, directors and actors and writers. But you know, things sort of splintered, and I kind of just went off on my own direction, and there wasn't, and again, at that time, there weren't any other design or specifically lighting design blogs.
Sure.
Out there, that at least that I knew of.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I just sort of went off into my own world, and I would write, and actually, you know, sort of it would lapse at times. You know, I'd go a couple months without writing anything. You know, because, I mean, blogging can be this incredibly lonely experience if there's not a conversation going
sure.
on. It's like I'm putting all of this effort into, you know, throwing these ideas out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
nobody's talking back.
Nobody's talking back. Sometime last year, I'm just not remembering the exact timeline.
No problem.
I realized that I was missing actively writing. And noticed that because it was sort of like, you know, if I was particularly, you know, if I was feeling particularly prolific, I would write and write and write and write. And if, you know, if I wasn't, then I wouldn't. And I would, you know, I might write multiple posts, you know, in a day or a week, and I might go weeks or months without writing. And that wasn't really working for me. So, so I sort of imposed on myself a bi-weekly schedule. You know, I'm going to post on Mondays and Fridays. And it was as soon as I sort of set the intention of I'm going to stick to the schedule, my writing became much more regular. Like, I came up with more ideas on a regular basis. And it sort of became easier for me to write. And And from that, and I think some of it was just by sort of imposing that discipline, my writing itself got more disciplined instead of just sort of being off the cuff, like, oh, I'm doing this, you know, because you read some of my older blog posts, like, I'm doing this and that, I'm working on this show, and here's some thoughts about that, and it's, you know, it's very sort of scattered, just what's sort of happening in my brain that day, and once I imposed this more regular schedule, it became much more... The writing itself became much more sort of clear,
uniform,
methodical,
well thought out process.
Well thought out
thought process. Yeah.
Well, you know, once I started imposing this discipline on the on when I was posting, my whole sort of orientation to the writing and the style of writing changed, and I started doing much more well thought out, you know, planned series of posts rather than the, well, today I'm doing this, that, the other, so on and so forth.
Yeah, like you do in Twitter where, oh, I'm having lunch today.
Right, exactly.
You know. Now you're getting into more detailed, you know, thought process of, so, like, your series about freelance lighting designers and money.
Yeah, no, that was sort of the first, like, really methodical series that I did where, actually, I mean, the post that kicked it off sort of happened in that spontaneous way of, like, oh, like... Here are, you know, I've been freelancing, it's really troublesome, let me, you know, I've had a lot of difficulty figuring out how to make this work, you know, let me, you know, sort of, here's what I've learned, and, you know, and I wrote the initial post, and sort of from that were, you know, a couple of ideas, and then it was like, oh, like, each of the, you know, each of these ideas could be its own post, and so I, you know, I went out and I started, you know, I laid out each post and did, you know, sort of expanded each of those ideas, and from there I've done a couple of series that sort of in that more sort of large scope,
essentially a book in chapters kind of.
Yeah, I mean, sort of thinking more in chapter term or miniseries term, exactly.
Okay, so I know right now you're working on a color theory one. You got a couple posts up there, like five, you said, right?
I think I just posted the fifth this morning.
So we've got the color theory. Go in a little bit about the color theory. I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Because
we were talking a little earlier, you know, with color theory, the psychology, the philosophy. You know, how does that play into color theory?
Sure. It's interesting. I mean, the color was one of the first things that drew me to lighting design specifically, and I think that's true for a lot of people. I think it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, wow, all these pretty colors, and I can do all this cool stuff with it, and, like, look how, like, when I turn on this, you know, red backlight, it's really intense, and that's such an intense emotion, and how cool is that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, I mean, I remember doing some show early on, and it was some, like, night scene, and I was, like, turning on all this blue, and I was like, oh, wow, it must be really cold out. You know, and I was just, like, thinking of, like, it looks so cold, and I had to go on stage to, like, fix something, and I walk out on stage, and, of course, you know, the lights have been on for, you know, however long that I've been sitting in the theater, and it's blazing hot, because there's, you know, how many lights, like, pouring onto the stage, and it was this wonderful moment of, like, oh, right, I'm creating an illusion.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, and so much of that, and so much of that being done through color. And I think what's interesting about color is, you know, and I've done, I mean, everything from, like, formally studying it. I mean, one of the reasons why I went to graduate school at NYU was that there's a heavy focus on color theory from, you know, like, from the John Gleason days, sort of, you know, transmitted down, and, you know, Robert Witzel teaches there, who's a, you know, he makes very bold color choices in his designs. And, you know, so I mean, some of my impetus for going there to study was, you know, here are these, like, masters of color, and here's this, you know, this thing that's particularly interesting to me about lighting. And so from studying with them to just reading on my own about, like, the psychology of perception and, you know, different, you know, sort of how people react to color and, you know, like, color in advertising, color in restaurants, you know, that, like, fast food restaurants fine-tune the colors to make you eat as quickly as possible.
Sure, sure.
And really, I mean, we, you know, so much of our, I forget the exact number, but it's around, like, 70% of the sensory information that the human brain deals with is visual, mm-hmm. and, you know, at least half of that is color information, right? So, I mean, this is a huge part of how the human brain perceives the world that it's in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, in my field of, you know, sort of this, you know, creating illusions, it's, you know, I mean, that is a very powerful tool in terms of, you know, in terms of evoking certain responses, if, you know, if you want to get that sort of direct about it, or, you know, just sort of generally like creating atmospheres and creating moods and...
color certainly helps.
You know, and it's just a very powerful tool for doing that. And I mean, really, it's fun. You know, like, you look through the gel books, you know, oh, wow, I haven't used that color. You know, wow, that, like, you know, this color and that color to get, like, that would be interesting. What would that look like, you know? And it's, you know, and it's just sort of a fun process. And,
well, yeah, that also plays into the whole, you know, you never stop learning with lighting. You can certainly stop your education.
Sure.
But I've always been under the assumption that I'm never stopped playing with light or discovering with light more than learning about light, discovering about light, and that just portrays it exactly right there.
Yeah, no, I think that's really the case, that we, you know, I mean, certainly, you know, I think that, you know, as long as you're always at least open to learning, if not actively pursuing knowledge, you're always growing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly if you're, you know, any kind of a visual artist, whether, you know, from a painter or a sculptor to a designer for live performance, you are, you know, you're a visual artist, and that learning process is, in order for your art to progress, that learning process needs to be part of it, whether it's learning from other, you know, from outside sources, or just testing your own boundaries and questioning your own assumptions. And, you know, I mean, it's, you know, a game that I like to play from time to time is, you know, it's like, you know, always put some color that you've never used, or some lighting source, or, you know, like, I mean, whether, you know, it doesn't have to be color, but it can be, you know, it can be a source, it can be some combination of angles, it can be, you know, some
something
instrument, but something
before.
That you've never used before as a way of not just keeping it fresh, but really, like, challenging your boundaries. It's like, oh, you know, like, I've, you know, whatever, like, I've, wow, I realized that, you know, the last 7 shows I did had Lee 201 backlight. Lee 201 backlight's fine, but there's, you know, there's a lot of other options, you know. Do I, you know, maybe I can try whatever. Do I need backlight? Let's do a show without backlight. You know, I mean, just, but, you know, seriously, like just, you know, sort of constantly opening up those sort of questions of what, you know, like, what really is necessary, and what is necessary in this moment or for this piece, you know, and there's certainly, and I, you know, and I think, like you were saying, that sense of learning and exploration and sort of openness is really keeps the work alive and keeps it fun, interesting, and engaging.
Yeah, I don't think that ever stops, you know, the self-learning or self-taught or whatever you want to call it. I've always felt if I want to get better, keep playing, keep learning, keep experimenting with light from one angle to another angle. And with color, like you're saying, maybe not try the Lee 201 for backlight. Maybe try, you know, R333, a pink, whatever you want. So with all this great information that you've got on your website, you know, you've got the whole finances for a freelancer, the series that you're finishing up with Color Theory. Any hints on some future mini-series books? Mini sessions that you're going to, or series, excuse me, that you're going to be putting up?
Well,
something to preview?
Something to preview. I've been thinking about sort of dealing with a series on templates.
Okay. A huge part of our business.
It is. And, you know, specifically sort of looking at, you know, the differences between sort of technological solutions like, you know, the GAN film effects versus, you know, more old school version of, you know, just like laying out multiple clouds and, you know, varying intensities and sharpness and creating the same sense of movement and dynamic sort of sky patterns. You know, and looking at the relationship between sort of like a more traditional approach versus a more, you know, like using technology to solve a problem.
Okay. Awesome. Approach. I can't wait to read that series. But I guess you got to finish Color Theory first.
I got to finish Color Theory. I've got my sort of open-ended series that I just started on the last couple of shows. Going into the specific design process for the show.
Oh, great.
I did one on the play, The Sisters Rosenzweig, that just closed in San Francisco, and then the second one was for this sort of experimental multimedia dance piece that I'm actually in D.C. right now for. And sort of as projects, you know, come online and start, you know, the designs get developed, I'll be sort of posting those. They seem to get, you know, favorable responses, and they're interesting to write.
Cool. That's awesome. Well, you know, you're putting a lot of great information out there. You know, I love reading it. You know, certainly because I cover something totally separate from you, so
sure. You're
not competition to me at all. Actually, I consider you an ally, so fight the power, right? You know, with all this great information that you're putting out there, have you ever thought about going into teaching?
I certainly have. I mean, aside from, like, you know, these great, like, masters of color that I mentioned that I went to study with at NYU, one of the reasons why I was interested in getting a master's degree, because, like, you don't need a degree to do lighting. You
No.
need an interest and, you know, ability to
Certainly
do lighting.
Certainly a little bit of talent.
You know, talent helps. It can also be cultivated. Like,
sure.
And certainly, you know, I mean, one thing that a degree program does is it puts you in this, you know, sort of pressure cooker environment to really, you know, cultivate your craft and your art and all of that. But I also was, you know, I mean, my family, you know, got a long line of teachers. And it's certainly something that I've always considered. And I didn't want to get to the point where, oh, now I want to teach.
Sure.
And now I need to go back and get a degree. So I was like, here's this, you know. To answer your question, it's something that I've thought of quite
but
a bit.
Yeah.
I'm definitely, you know, interested in doing at some point. The opportunity hasn't yet arisen.
Sure, sure. So you've got the prerequisites, we'll say, to
sure.
become one. But how's the freelance lighting design world treating you right now?
It's been interesting. The work itself is amazing. I mean, I think that's the first thing I need to say about freelancing. Like, I love it. You know, I love that, you know, I get to, you know, pick what I do. I get these opportunities to travel all over the country and internationally. I meet all these different people, you know, there's no going to the office and it's the same, you know, 5, 20, 50 people every day. It's, you know, every week or two, it's, you know, a different set of people in a different city or a different country if, you know, you're fortunate enough.
Yep.
And that's really fantastic. That said, you know, in the current economic situation, it's become increasingly difficult to manage just as, you know, producers are cutting back and, you know, funding is getting cut. And it's, you know, and it's interesting to see that there was, you know, right when the economy crashed, there was a big wave of people who just stopped producing or way cut down. And then there were, you know, this whole other set of companies that, you know, had endowments from the year before, and so they were able to weather the immediate crisis, and now, you know, this much later, this next season is sort of the second round of companies that are starting to scale back, and, you know, I'm finding, you know, companies are less willing to fly people out from out of town,
Yeah. And
people are definitely, you know, playing their cards close. That said, you know, there's still, you know, work out there, and I still, you know, definitely enjoy it.
Oh, great.
So
for aspiring lighting designers, you know, that want to do this for a living, you know, not necessarily maybe freelancing, but we all have to do it at some point. Do you have any pointers, you know, goals or things, advice to give these young persons, you know, to help transition to that lifestyle or become a successful light designer?
To the freelancing specifically, I think doing it in stages is certainly would be sort of my first piece of advice, which is sort of what I did. I after when I finished graduate school, I did 2 seasons at the San Francisco Opera as a resident lighting assistant. So I had there are short seasons. It's a four-month season.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least a 4 month of pre-production where they need the extra assistant. And so I would, you know, I went there and it was a job, and I, you know, went in, you know, 6 days a week, and mm-hmm. I focused more lights than I can possibly remember. And
well, you're young, you had to.
Oh yeah, no, that was the job. It was great. It was fantastic. You know.
Yep.
And but all of that is to say that, you know, for the first 2 years that I was freelancing, I was only freelancing half time because I had a steady job. You know, I knew where my money was coming from, and I, you know, socked a bit away to, you know, because like I didn't know for the next, you know, 6+ months where the money was going to come from. You know, I'd have a gig or two lined up, but that's the nature of the work. Is, you know, you might have something, you know, you might have your work planned out for the whole year. You might go into a year having no idea what's going to happen, and it's this constant surprise. You know, you might have your year planned out and everything goes away. You know, there's all these permutations. But exactly. So, but you know, to start out and you know, maybe working half time and then freelancing half time, whether you can do like a seasonal thing or a summer thing, that to sort of transition. And once the freelance work, as the freelance work picks up, then starting to decrease the regular work until you're sort of on your own and just subsisting on the freelance work.
One last idea I wanted to throw out there, going back to the blog with all the great series that you've written so far and hopefully even more series of posts coming up. What about a book deal? Any book ideas in the works there? Or is that like way too far out?
Oh, no, that's awesome. Like, if you know a publisher, send it my direction. I'd be more than happy to. That said, I'm not actively looking for it. Though, speaking of books, I just got a copy of Steve Shelley's revised Practical Guide to Stage Lighting, which
second edition.
The first edition of which I think is hands down the best textbook on lighting design out there, and then he made the second edition, which is now most likely the best textbook on lighting design out there, that I'm in the process of reading and will hopefully have a book review of on the blog.
Soon. Okay, great.
Now,
you mentioned books, reading the Steve Sheldon, little before we were sitting down and doing the recording, you mentioned something about Stanley McKinless's book. I want to get this on record, so let's hear a little
now
bit
I'm in
of
trouble.
Of course you are. I want to hear a little bit more about your thoughts about Stanley McKinless' theory. I actually thought it was really interesting how you explained his theory, where technology is and where it was.
Sure.
I thought that was really interesting. I'd love to hear that.
Okay. Well, I think that let me see if I can remember how I phrased that. One of the things that, I love like old lighting textbooks. I love looking at old lighting paperwork. The Lighting Archive, I think it's called, and the New York Public Library Performing Arts Library are starting to archive all of this old lighting work, mm-hmm. which is amazing. I mean, it's like, it's geek heaven to me. It's like poring over, Gene Rosenthal's handwritten hookup for some musical that hasn't been produced in 70 years. You know, it's really astounding. So, like, that kind of lighting history I find fascinating. Particularly in sort of when you look at like old, older theories of, whether it's like Stanley McCandless or Gene Rosenthal, who are coming at lighting in a time where the infrastructure did not support the vision, did not fully support the vision. So mm-hmm. you have these like amazing minds dealing with, trying to do a musical on 30 dimmers, or whatever.
Sure.
Like, you've got 24 dimmers in a 3-act play. How do you light it? And this is the problem that everyone had. If you're working, if you're just starting out doing showcases in New York or whatever, city you're in, you know, you're still running into this problem. You've got 12 dimmers and 17 park hands go to town on this musical. Excuse me?
Exactly.
You know, and I think one of the things that's so interesting about Stanley McCandless, and I've got my own issues with the method itself, but as far as an approach, I think it's sort of brilliant in terms of how he is, what he's doing is trying to maximize the potential in what he understands is a very limited situation. You know, it's like, I've got 12 dimmers, and, you know, I can do front light, back light, and maybe a couple of specials, you know, as long as I repatch by act, right? So what can I do? You know, and it's like, okay, I can do light through the window, I can do light through the other window, I can do backlight, and I can do front light. Okay, that's boring. How do we make this interesting? You know, and that's sort of where the McCandless method starts. And, you know, I mean, it, you know, it's sort of been, you know, expanded upon and revised, and certainly in a, you know, contemporary aesthetics would be like, really, diagonal front light? Are you sure you want to make that choice? But, you know, sort of, you know, at the time it was, you know, it was one way of sort of achieving that goal of maximizing the potential in a very limited situation. And and there's this point in the book where he sort of waxes philosophic about this imagined future that, you know, it's amazing because it reads to me as if he's like imagining this far out in the future, almost science fiction possibility of what would it be like in the future of lighting where a single light source could be hung such that it would illuminate the entirety of the stage and we would not have to contend with these multiple shadows. You would have a single source, you know, single shadow per person or object. You know, and the bounce from that would all serve to reflect, you know, the experience of sunlight outside. And basically what he's talking about is the 10K HMI or the 4K HMI, right? So this is technology that that's like common.
And yet
to him, it's this like way out there imagined future.
It's actually kind of interesting, you know, that you bring that up, using a 10K, 4K as your single source to light a whole show, like Stanley McCandless was thinking. You don't ever see anybody do that. You know, he's thinking about this way back when he was writing the book, and now that we have that technology, nobody does it.
Right. Well, it's funny. I actually have a post from a couple of years ago called, you know, something like, you know, it was some silly title like, you know, is Stanley McCandless really, you know, a German lighting designer or something like that. And because, you know, if you look at, you know, if you look at, you know, German opera or German dance, that very much is the perspective. And it's interesting because, you know, in this country we sort of went like there was Stanley McCandless and he was like all these little areas. And we went, wow, all these little areas, that's such a cool idea. Let's do a billion little areas. And let's do 10 billion little areas from every direction in 17 different colors and gobos. You know, and that's what Broadway theater is. It's, you know, you got lights from every direction, lighting every possible, you know, 8-foot chunk of stage in multiple colors and gobos and moving lights and, you know, and that's sort of this evolution from this theorist who, had he been able to implement, you know, the actual ideas and not contending with the technology, may well have gone in the direction of, like, you know, German minimalism, where you've got, you know, a single 10K diagonal backlight and maybe, you know, I don't know, a diagonal footlight or something coming from the other direction at like 2%.
Sure.
And, you know, and I just find that sort of interesting how, you know, so how those ideas did have manifested, but not necessarily from those who are sort of descended from his, you know, lineage, as it were.
Sure. Well, that's an interesting theory. I like that. I'll have to remember that. Well, Lucas, I think that's everything. I think I covered everything that I wanted to cover. Is there anything you wanted to leave us with? Hopefully not the tab.
Hopefully not the tab.
No, okay.
Oh my goodness, this is the part of the interview where I'm supposed to have something like clever.
Deep and meaningful is what
I'm hoping. Deep and meaningful and well prepared, which having been in a load-in all day,
I am not
well prepared. But
is anybody these days? Well, as a lighting designer, you better be.
You have no. It's true. I mean, that's no. I mean, if I was not, I have to over organize to compensate for my generally chaotic demeanor, which has led me to over time learn to be very organized. But
there you go.
It's by necessity more than natural inclination.
Well, Lucas, I want to thank you for not only joining me here on the podcast, but having a beer with me, man. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, this has been great. I'm glad that I was able to be in town and do a show in DC to meet up with you.
All right, man. Thanks again.
So there you have it, my conversation with fellow lighting designer Lucas Kresch. If you want to learn more about him, you can visit his website at www.lucaskresch.com or www.lucaskresch.com. Once again, thanks Lucas for joining me on this episode of the podcast. Look for more interviews and product announcements here on the iSquint podcast.